This is Luke Easter, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
Welcome to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. I'm Ryan Patton. This week, Luke Easter, former Tourniquet vocalist. Luke released a solo record in 2018 called The Pop Disaster. We spend the back portion of the podcast talking about that. Before that, we talk about growing up, his musical influences, how Brian Gray is the reason Luke joined Tourniquet, being in Tourniquet through their musical shifts, finding their way to Metal Blade, and beyond. I hope you guys enjoyed this week's chat with Luke Easter.
A Bay Area native, born in the city, grew up just a little bit outside, and with the exception of a year that we lived in Austin, I've been here my entire life.
What was that year in Austin for?
We needed a break. We'd visited there. I mean, I've traveled a lot, you know, playing with the band. I'd never been anywhere that I would actually have thought of moving to until my wife and I visited friends in Austin, and we thought it was really cool, and we'd been a few times, and I kind of hit the wall with the job situation I was in at the time. I was working for a church, and it had gotten really, really unhealthy. It just wasn't good anymore, and if I had stayed local, I would have probably adopted a scorched earth policy and lost all of the friendships and relationships that I had within that world. So we had been talking about doing it, so we just said, screw it, let's go. And we packed up and moved to Austin. And a little over a year later, we moved back.
It wasn't for you?
Too weird? Not that it wasn't. No, you know what? Honestly, I love it and I miss it. And if I had the resources at hand, I would pack up and go back immediately. We started getting a little squirrely, a little bit homesick, and about the time that started really hitting its peak, my wife was offered a position back here that seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, the timing was right, so, you know, our lease was up and, you know, on our apartment and all that stuff, so we packed up and moved home.
Gotcha. What was growing up like for you?
I grew up in church, what I would describe as a fairly standard, repressive, evangelical, fundy upbringing. Everything was forbidden, you know, going to the movies, good music. Although I shouldn't say that. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, old school Christian music that I grew up on that I would still say was good. But like normal mainstream stuff was forbidden. Most of the TV shows that my friends watched, I wasn't allowed to watch. I mean, like I've never seen Laverne and Shirley. By the time I could watch it, that lasted about 5 seconds. I was like, this is horrible.
Oh man.
So, you know, The regular, you know, late 70s to, you know, mid 80s fundamentalist, non-denominational upbringing. Very repressed.
Sure.
Beyond the mid-80s, I think, but yeah.
Start tapering off somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm sure there's still pockets of it out there, but I don't think it's like it was.
I hope not. Goodness. What got you into music?
I don't remember ever not being into music. I went to private school, private Christian school. I started school early. I was about four and a half when I started kindergarten. But I could already sing. And so we'd have chapel and such and, you know, music class, which was basically, you know, learning hymns and stuff and singing in a choral setting. And the music teacher figured out that I could carry a tune even at that age. So I would get a lot of solos and stuff in chapel and, just always loved it. You know, then as I got older and started getting into, you know, listening to records and whatnot, even as a kid, you know, like old Maranatha stuff or Second Chapter of Acts or whatnot, I would try and break down the parts they were doing, you know, the harmonies and, you know, why certain songs worked for me and why, you know, other ones didn't. And then that just progressed on through, you know, as I got into, you know, more mainstream music or even just stuff that was more suited to my age, you know, less churchy music. And then at some point you just get kind of arrogant and decide I can do as good or better than, you know, X, Y, or Z. And then you start playing in bands and falling on your face and hopefully getting better.
Have you always just been a vocalist, or did you ever dabble in playing instruments?
I was the world's worst bass player in my very first garage band. I'm a hack. I play enough guitar to be able to write and sketch stuff out in a demo. But I would never, ever play for people. Not at this point.
Gotcha. It's always been about being a vocalist.
Totally. Because I can do that. Or arguably, yeah. I can get the job done. Let me put it that way.
Sure. Were you singing in bands throughout high school and beyond?
No. The first band I was in was with friends from like middle school and high school. And we basically just banged around in the garage, you know, learning our instruments and trying to figure out how to play with people. Played like a couple of, you know, youth group type shows. And then just, you know, it was kind of over. And by that point, I knew I wanted to sing. And so I started scouring want ads in a local, there was a national version, or maybe it was regional, a magazine called BAM. Bay Area Music is what we called it, but found an ad for somebody looking for a singer and got somebody on the phone, talked my way into an audition, and managed to put off the actual audition for almost a month, convinced them to write first. So, you know, we kind of already had established a little bit of a rapport and, you know, had a couple things written that we worked out. So by that point, they were kind of stuck with me. And, I was with them for about 3 years, and it was another thing. It was like a step up from the garage with my old, you know, school friends, but it was still similar. It was a lot of wood shedding, a lot of, you know, three rehearsals a week, but not very many shows. And it was invaluable. I mean, I learned how to play with people. I learned how to, you know, I learned my place in terms of, you know, this is your role and this should be your attitude and your approach. And you know, learned all of it, learned how to perform, learned how to write, learned how to, resolve conflict when, you know, you aren't getting along with your bandmates. And not long after that, ran its course, I got the Tourniquet audition, and then I did that for almost 23 years.
That's cool. What was the name of the band before Tourniquet? Did it have a name?
It was called Heaven's Gate, and it was... I have a lot of fond memories. It was before that death cult happened. I'm still really good friends with all of those guys, and it was a lot of fun, but thankfully there's not really any material floating around because it's really cringy.
Silently vanishing, then reappearing, slipping away for a while. Got dematerializing before your eyes. Halloween's a step from my grave.
Were you into metal before Tourniquet?
Yeah, but more casually. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the 80s in the Bay Area, so you kind of, you know, had to like Metallica. I was more of a hard rock, you know, hair band type of guy. I spent a lot of time learning Bon Jovi songs. I think that, honestly, I think John vocally is probably my most obvious influence, although there's a lot of others that I was very into. But even listening to that, you know, as I got older, I got into, you know, Megadeth, Metallica, stuff like that. But I never thought that I would wind up in a metal band. You know, that was not what I was shooting for. I was hoping for more of a, I guess something more along the lines of like extreme, you know, where it was hooky and, you know, big choruses and catchy songs, but also, you know, fairly somewhat complex, you know, song structures and parts with, you know, and harmonies and all that. That's kind of what I was thinking I would do. And then Brian Gray from the Blamed, and the Blame didn't even exist then, as far as I know. He was still with Rocks and Pink Cement. Pointed me in the direction of Tourniquet and put me in touch with Victor. And I got the audition. And I thought he was nuts when he told me that I should try out. And he's like, no, you can do this. I'm like, dude, you've heard what I do. He's like, yeah, I think you could totally do this. You just don't know it. I'm like, okay. So, you know, I guess he was right.
That's interesting. Did you have any, when you joined Tourniquet, did you know that there would be a musical shift into more of a hard rock away from the tech metal stuff when you joined?
No. When I joined, so let's see, I knew they didn't have a singer. I owned the first three records. Chris Canoho, who produced my solo record and played guitar on it, he's one of my oldest, dearest friends. He had originally turned me on to Tourniquet when Stop the Bleeding came out. So by the time it got to Pathogenic, my guitar player at the time from Heaven's Gate, we'd gone to the NAMM show and ran into Gary. And he mentioned that Guy had left. And so I knew that they didn't have a singer. So when Brian, you know, told me I should get the audition, you know, I figured they'd have somebody lined up, but then I got it. So at that point, it was, you know, I was more concerned with learning all the lyrics because, you know, Pathogenic especially is a very, very wordy record. You know, and I auditioned, and then a week later, I was back down there for rehearsals, back down in L.A., and then a week after that, we were playing outside of Tulsa, kicking off the tour. So I, like, had, you know, a little over a week to learn all these songs and be able to keep them straight and play a show. So, stylistic shifts. And I mean, honestly, I didn't even think about, you know, the record, doing a record. I mean, it was in the back of my mind. I'd always, you know, I was like, this is it. I'm going to have my shot. I get to make a record. But I was just concerned with being able to deliver every night and, making sure that the band was happy, but more importantly that, you know, the fans, the people that came out to see us and who already loved that band, were satisfied as much as possible. So by the time we did Vanishing Lessons, I wasn't surprised at the shift because there had been stuff that was said, you know, over that previous year or whatever that I'd been in the band. In terms of, oh, we had this idea that we never got to, you know, try out. Oh, you can do this, so we might try that on the next record. But it wasn't really until we got to pre-production that I had any idea that it was going to be, as big a shift. And honestly, in pre-production, it didn't seem like as big a shift because, other than the fact that, we didn't have any songs with Gary doing his vocal on, live in the practice room, it still sounded, you know, heavy and huge. It wasn't till, you know, we were partway through and we were hearing, you know, reference mixes and stuff in the course of production that it was like, oh, wow, this is different for us. You know, I've always thought that even though it was a little bit of a musical left turn, in terms of style, I think it still sounds, it sounds like a natural progression. You know, when you factor in what was going on at the time and that I was a completely, different type of vocalist than Guy was, that it just made sense that, oh, let's try this other stuff.
Did you personally take any heat in the stylistic thing? Or do people point to you and say like, oh, the band's changed, but it's his fault?
There was a little bit of that, but honestly, not that much. Not that I was aware of anyway. The thing that I mostly heard was I didn't know what to expect, especially, you know, from people that saw the Pathogenic tour. I didn't know what to expect, but you handled the material really well, and I think you're a good fit. That's what I would hear a lot. And, you know, obviously there's always going to be that, you know, small subgroup of haters. You know, you're not the original, so you suck. You know, and that's fine.
Right.
I'm sure there's people that, you know, hate Ringo because he wasn't the original drummer for the Beatles. You know, who cares? Sure. Life goes on, things change, and just because you played in a band together doesn't mean you're going to always play in a band together. You know, things are what they are. I just always tried to just, you know, do my best and deliver whatever the song required and whatever the occasion required.
Yeah. And then that shift from Vanishing Lessons into Crawl to China was more natural. Did that feel more like your natural sound or style as what you were into previously and what you thought you'd be in as opposed to metal?
Again, it wasn't really that thought out. I mean, by that point, I'd already been in for a couple of years. I mean, I joined in 93 and we recorded Crawl in, you know, late 96, early 97. So, you know, I'd already been doing it for a couple of years. I'd done Vanishing, I'd done Carrie, and we did the new tracks on the Collected Works record. So I was already comfortable, you know, with the, you know, this is my job, this is what I do. And so by the time we got to Crawl, we knew we wanted to do something different because we'd kind of gone as far in you know, the hard rock direction as we could, you know, between Vanishing and Carrie. Initially, we kind of talked about it being like, you know, Hand Trembler and Perfect Night. But by the time we got in there and, you know, started doing the things we were doing, we realized it sounded like something, you know, completely different. So we just ran with it, you know. It was a fun record to make because it was basically us and our producer in a, excuse me, in a rehearsal. There was a recording facility inside a rehearsal place that we used to rehearse in L.A. And so we'd just be in there, you know, with no windows. It just, you know, long, long days, just playing stuff. You know, Ted was, you know, coming up with really cool ideas. You know, Aaron and I wrote a couple things, and you know, by the time we reached the end, it sounded like Crawl to China. And it's another one. I don't. To me, it doesn't. Yes, it sounds different, but it doesn't sound like it doesn't fit in the discography.
Sure.
You know, because it's still us. It's still my voice. It's still, you know, Ted's drumming, Aaron's playing. I think what threw people off was the fact that we didn't go for as much of a, you know, metal type of guitar sound. We almost every song on that record has a different guitar sound. And so, yeah. You know, we would tweak things, you know, oh, you know, Bat sounds like it should have this kind of guitar sound and Proprioception sounds like it should have this kind of guitar sound. So we just, you know, kind of scratched that itch creatively. And in the end, you know, we were very happy with that record. You know, a lot of people, I've heard people say over the years, oh, The label made them do that record. Label didn't make us do anything. You know, we did what we always did. We wrote the record we wanted to do, and we went in and made it, and we handed in, and, you know, dealt with whatever came in the aftermath. And some people really love that record. Some people are, you know, ambivalent about it. I'm still proud of it. I think we, you know, that it's a perfect snapshot of who we were at that point in time in what was kind of a transitional period again for that band, you know, because we'd lost Gary, we'd lost Victor, and now the only original member was the drummer, and, you know, Aaron and I were there.
Can't I see it in the light?
Sometimes I think it's easier to listen to a band and then go backwards and appreciate what they did before if you like what they're doing currently, as opposed to going forward and being like, oh yeah, the early stuff was better, right?
Exactly. I mean, I have bands like that, but I love their first record and I don't like their second record as much. And then by the third record, I'm like, meh, and I just keep going. But then, yeah, there's other ones that you find them, you know, and you're like, wait a minute, where has this been all my life? And, you know, do a deep dive into the rest of it and realize that there's a whole, you know, treasure trove of stuff that you never knew existed and it's blowing your mind and you can't believe you hadn't heard it before.
What led you guys to Metal Blade Records? How did that relationship come about?
Bill, our producer at the time, was a VP there.
Okay.
They had released Pathogenic in the secular market. And so after we did Crawl, well, even back around the time of Crawl, I think there had been some discussion about maybe trying to get Metal Blade to push Crawl into the secular market. And when Slagle heard it, he didn't think it was a good fit, and he passed. So when we found ourselves, well, we didn't even find ourselves, when we got out of our deal with Benson, we, you know, had a relationship, you know, with Metal Blade, and we had access through Bill. So we, you know, threw out the idea of, you know, could we maybe make our home here? And Brian wasn't sure if that would be a good fit. But in the meantime, as a, you know, as a way of staying current and partly just to do something different again, because we'd started playing acoustic shows mostly overseas when we would, you know, go play, we decided to do Acoustic Archives. And then tagged, you know, Trivializing on the end of that, which I think probably is still the heaviest thing that any incarnation of that band has done. And, you know, Brian was like, well, hey, if that's the direction you guys are going to go, then I think this could work. And so the timing was good. You know, we did that song that we were really proud of. And by that point, had kind of decided, okay, we've done these other things. We should probably, or not even should probably, I think it's time to kind of go back to basics and just, you know, make the heaviest record that we can right now, which became Microscopic.
Yeah, so that was a conscious decision to go back to playing the metal and more in that vibe.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't say that any of the other stuff was necessarily not metal. It was just maybe not as...
Sure.
You know, metal-wise. But yeah, that was a conscious decision to, you know, let's turn everything up to 11. Let's just try and and obliterate everything sonically that we can, rip everyone's faces off, and then just, you know, make a you know, quote unquote true metal record. Which ironically is when things started getting a lot more proggy too. You've got, you know, flutes and bouzoukis and, you know, God knows whatever else, violins.
And then between Moth and Rust to 2012, Antiseptic Bloodbath, what was the status of the band for that decade? You guys kind of took some time off?
Yes and no. The industry had changed. We had, as I understand it, we had a deal with Metal Blade that was, it's not unusual to, you know, when you sign a record deal and say, hey, we have a 5-album deal. Yes, technically it's a 5-album deal, but if you were, you don't sell enough, you know, or if you have a falling out with the label, it's not guaranteed that you're going to make, you know, the record. So we had signed a deal with Metal Blade for, you know, X number of records, but it was an option. So both sides had to agree to do the next one. So we did Microscopic, and it did really well for, you know, all involved. Everybody was happy with the performance. And then we did Moth, and, you know, due to stuff that was beyond our control, a lot of Metal Blade product got sent back by Christian retail. And we weren't big enough in the secular arena to shift the units that we were accustomed to moving with a record. So on paper, the record looked like it stiffed, even though we ended up selling more in the secular market than we had previously, because that's basically the only place you could get it. So when we told Metal Blade we were ready to make a record, they said, great, here's the terms. And they weren't the terms that we had originally agreed to, and they weren't the terms that we were happy with. So we, you know, no bad blood or anything. We said that's not what we wanted. And they're like, well, that's all we can do right now. And we said, okay. So we parted ways, thinking that we would just do like we'd always done. We, you know, we'd never been without a deal up until that point. But things had changed. The industry had changed. Nobody was just signing bands. We were not a touring band. You know, we certainly, you know, played, you know, but we weren't road dogs. And so it was an uphill battle trying to get anybody to pay attention to us. So in the meantime, Kickstarter had happened. And I became aware of it because I'm a huge Steve Taylor fan, and he had financed the budget for his record, Blue Like Jazz, or not his record, sorry, his movie version of Blue Like Jazz. They had raised the money for that through Kickstarter. So that caught my interest. And so I told Ted, and he looked into it. And so we decided to do the Kickstarter campaign, which is what resulted in Antiseptic Bloodbath. But the rest of that time, it was, we certainly weren't, you know, slacking off. But we also, you know, were kind of, you know, beating our heads against a wall trying to get, you know, anybody to pay attention to us. And to be fair, too, I mean, you know, there were so many other bands that had come up in that time as well and that were out there, you know, slogging it out, you know, grinding it out on the road, you know, bands like Disciple and people like that, that had taken up a lot of the space in that, you know, that arena. And so, you know, we were just some old dudes that had been around for a long time and hadn't done anything in a while. So I completely understand why nobody was interested.
Yeah, between that 10-year period and then just like, what was it like watching the scene change and explode, especially in Christian metal from 93 when you joined Tourniquet to 2012?
It was interesting. I mean, I live out here on the West Coast, so there's like no Christian radio and almost nobody routes through here in terms of touring. So I was peripherally aware of it. I mean, the internet, you know, was finally a thing and you could kind of keep tabs on people. And obviously I'm friends with some of those guys, so I was aware of things that were happening, but, it wasn't as much in the forefront of my mind as it would be if I like lived in Nashville or something, you know, where a lot of those people either live or, you know, run through all the time. But it was frustrating. I mean, I like to think that we were a good band. And knowing that, you know, when we're given a shot, we've always, you know, pretty much always delivered. It was frustrating and a little bit disheartening to, you know, not have anybody, you know, willing to bite. But again, a lot of that was our fault. We, you know, I don't want to, you know, go into too many details, but there was a resistance to touring by some within the band, which honestly, it was probably at the root of some of the lineup changes over the years too. Some people wanted to, you know, work and make a run at it and were rebuffed. And so they moved on. But that hurt us, you know. It's one thing to say, hey, look, we make really good records and people really like us, you know, but it's another thing when they say, that's awesome, we'd love to work with you. How many shows did you play last year? Zero. Okay, well, call us when you want to play.
Yeah.
So I get it. I mean, at the time, it was like, you guys suck. You know we can do this. But, you know, time and whatnot has a way of changing your perspective a little bit. And I get it now. I would have said, yeah, you guys are not serious. So, no, we're not going to risk money that is harder and harder to come by in this business. On what's really become, I mean, up to that point, up until Antiseptic, what a lot of people, I think, were thinking of as a nostalgia act.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did you guys ever get any pushback for some of the political content on the records, especially like being as heavy animal rights as the band was? Did people ever push back on that?
Sometimes, but, you know, not that much. By the time I joined the band, that had really, it had become our calling card. So people expected it. I don't follow them really anymore since I've left the band, but I would imagine, that there's still pushback from people that are like, we get it. You like animals, you know, can we talk about something else? You know, but there's also a lot of people that thought it was really cool that, you know, we weren't just the normal CCM band that was singing about the same things that everybody else was. There's plenty of things to talk about. I mean, I don't understand why everybody in that scene, at the time anyway, I believe in the Great Commission, you know, when Jesus told us to go out into the world and, you know, make disciples. You know, I totally believe in that. I think that is what anybody who professes Christ at some level should be doing. But there's so much more to talk about in terms of the human existence and life in general than just the salvation message. So, you know, yeah, I loved a lot of those bands in the 80s, you know, especially a lot of the frontline bands, you know, musically and whatnot. But I look back at some of the lyric content and it's like, wow, you guys really only had that one thing to talk about. You guys didn't really have a whole lot of depth in terms of your day-to-day existence, did you? You know? But even that, I mean, I say that and I have to, you know, walk it back a little bit because it's also just where the scene was at the time. You know, it was still new. You know, I think I came into it in kind of an in-between period, you know, where it went from the super evangelistic, you know, quote unquote preachy stuff like, you know, Stryper would have done, you know, contrasted against, you know, like what Switchfoot does now. Not that they're metal, but just in terms of, you know, the lyric content and being more open to discussing other issues and not purely salvation. We'll be right back.
What led you to leave the band?
That's not a question for me because I didn't leave. We did not part ways until the end of 2015. And when I did that guest spot on that solo record by the drummer, I was still in the band at that time.
Well, in 2018, you released a solo record called The Pop Disaster. Talk to me about that record.
It's something that I'd wanted to do for a long time. My friend Chris and I have been talking about doing a record together since we were still in high school. And it had just never been the right time. Sometimes it was on my end, sometimes it was on his end, but it had never really come together. And so when I parted ways with that band, it was a little bit bleak, and I was really questioning whether I was going to do music or not anymore. And Chris encouraged me, like, hey, we've got, you know, these demos that we've done together, you know, that you've written over the years, and you know, I know you have other stuff that you've been working on. Let's just, you know, figure out, do you want to do a single? Do you want to do, you know, what do you want to do? So I decided on an EP. And, you know, we went through some of the material that, you know, we already had done. And I worked up some of the new material, and we picked the best songs out of that bunch. And that became The Pop Disaster.
Going that direction of more of a pop rock feel, was that something that felt natural for you to do at that point?
Yes. Because at the end of the day, I mean, I can be as metal as I want to be. You know, I was very much at home, you know, doing the yelled vocals and the more high, you know, pitched vocals and, you know, all of it, the aggression, you know, the volume, all of it. You know, I wasn't, you know, faking it when I was playing in that type of band. But in terms of how my head is wired musically, if I'm going to write stuff, it tends to skew to more of a power pop, you know, pop rock, hard rock kind of thing. Partly because that's more where my roots are, but also partly because that's just the kind of music that 9 times out of 10, if I'm, you know, driving somewhere and I put something on, it's probably going to be in that vein, you know. I mean, there's some days where it's just like, you know what, I just want to listen to Pantera and, you know, go right to, you know, Vulgar Display. But, you know, more often than not, it's going to be a Butch Walker record. So, yeah, it was very natural. And it was deliberate. I mean, it didn't make sense to me to try and do a metal record because that's...
Sure.
It would have felt contrived and it would have felt forced because I would have been like, oh, I got to make it sound like, you know. So going into it is very conscious that if it sounds even remotely metal, then that idea gets tossed.
I know Ted did most of the lyrics for Tourniquet, if not all of them. How do you feel writing the lyrics for this? Is that something you've always wanted to do and take more of a bigger role in?
I've always written, you know. I mean, the band I was in prior to Tourniquet, I was, you know, the primary lyricist. So in some ways coming into Tourniquet where there was already kind of a songwriting hierarchy established, it was kind of nice because it meant there was no pressure on me. But it was challenging, you know, writing songs, in that band. Because musically, I didn't come up with parts musically, so I had to write to music that other people had written, which, you know, when it works is great. When it doesn't, it's really difficult. but you know, it is what it is with those songs. But on the side, you know, once I decided I was going to try and write songs by myself, the lyrics are honestly the easiest part. I mean, it's not to say I just, you know, throw them together and say, hey, look, here's, you know, here's word salad. It doesn't really mean anything, but it's catchy. You know, I put a lot of thought into what I'm trying to say, but it's way more challenging for me to come up with the musical element of it, because, you know, I'm not primarily an instrumentalist, you know, so I might hear something in my head, but I might not necessarily be able to play it. So I have to figure out how to musically get the point across to Chris so that he can help me realize it and then make the words that I've written fit over that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Is there a theme on the songs on the Pop Disaster?
Consciously, no. But early on when we were mixing, I played it for a good friend who knows me really well. And he pointed out, he's like, this is seven songs about love and loss. I'm like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, I get that. And because it does sum it up a lot, you know, I think the opening track and the closing track, Life Goes On and Sleep, I think are very similar songs, which is partly why they bookend the record. But one of them is more anthemic and more, you know, come on, you can do this. We can, you know, life goes on. Let's go. Whereas the other one is basically the same sentiment, but making the allowance, you know, that, hey, you know what? Chill, take a break, because, you know, it is hard. So, you know, just take a beat, take a breath and sleep. But then everything else in the middle is, you know, I mean, the same person told me that, this is going to sound self-aggrandizing, and I don't mean it to, that it was like listening to a paraphrase of the book of Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, you know, all of this is meaningless. What does this mean? You know, I'd like to discuss that more with him and unpack that a little bit, but we haven't gotten to connect in a while. But I thought that was an interesting take, because I do think that I tried to make an optimistic record, but I know it's got some cynical moments in it. I did a holiday single, and did a even more pop version than Pop Disaster. Did a cover of Last Christmas from Wham, and then I guessed it on a track for Gary Lanier. Originally, he put it out as a single, and then it was just remixed and re-released on his new album. But currently, I'm in the writing process. I started demoing about a week or two ago, partly to get some of the sounds out of my head and into my Mac so that I can figure out what needs to change so that it fits the melodies and the lyrics in my head. And, you know, once I have enough of the record written, I imagine Chris and I'll start chipping away at it and recording it. So, you know, up until California went onto a lockdown, I was optimistic that we might be able to have a record out by the end of the year. But given that there's so much topsy turvy going on in the world with this whole coronavirus thing currently, it might take a little bit longer for things to settle down so that we can get to work. But there will definitely be a follow up to the Pop Disaster, and it'll definitely be a full length. And hopefully I can take the lessons I learned doing the first release, because it was self-released. Hopefully I can apply some of the lessons I learned, make a little bit of a bigger splash, and hopefully put together some live dates.
Another day gone, one less to get through, another chance to obsess, another chance to second guess, another chance to question your every thought, to blame yourself for whatever's wrong. I pray you find peace.
I'm going to ask you one more question. You mentioned Brian Gray. What led you to sing on their, again, 20th anniversary EP?
Brian reached out and asked me if I would do it. Actually, I should have mentioned that when I was rattling off stuff earlier about stuff that I've done in the last year or so. That was purely just Brian saying, hey, we're doing this thing. Do you think you might want to, you know, guest on a track? And, you know, I mean, it's flattering. Brian is Brian. He's played with everybody. But he's also somebody that, you know, I wouldn't call us, you know, best friends or anything like that, but I've known Brian, you know, in some way or form for a long, long time. So to finally get to do something with him was awesome. And had the bonus of having, you know, Chaffin on there. So I can, you know, tick that off the bucket list. I got to sing over something Jim drummed on. So yeah, it was really just the, you know, the friendship aspect of it. Hey, we're doing this thing. You want to come play? Yes, I would love to. It was fun. And cause I hadn't gone into that like headspace or, you know, vocal territory in, you know, almost 5 years at that point. And so he's like, you know, you can do whatever you want on it, but I want like the full on, you know, Luke Easter, you know, the full metal treatment. I'm like, okay, well, but I can do whatever I want. He's like, yeah, do whatever you want. So he sent me the track and, you know, Chris set up the mic and we just went for it.
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening.
I never felt so young and alive as when I'm diving into a tune. And now I'm learning as I listen along, and the wheels are turning, and I started a song.